Okay, welcome to episode 3 of Magnus and Marcus on coaching. I'm here with John Marcus as always. Hope you guys had enjoyed the first 2 episodes, and we're just going to keep at it and keep the vibe kind of light and jump into another topic. How are you doing, John?
Doing great, Steve. Good to be back.
Good. Well, in discussing things, the topic which I'm really excited about that we figured we'd delve into is basically weight training, right? Strength training, for lack of a better term. Was wondering if you wanted to get the ball rolling and maybe start with some controversy on strength in distance runners.
I think the biggest controversy that typically comes to coaches' minds, and even some athletes' minds, at least from my experience, is like, if you get in the weight room, your distance runners are going to get bulky. They're going to get big. They're going to put on all this muscle mass. That's then going to slow them down, and their, velocity of VO2 max is going to decline and suffer, and their efficiency is going to go, way down because they're too heavy. I hear that so many times from coaches. I shouldn't lift that much. We don't want to get too bulky. So, it's another tool in your toolkit, or in toolbox, so to speak, about how you use that, how you integrate that into your training. Because if you understand what the goal is from a distance runner's perspective to get the strength training stuff going, and sequencing it in with your running training, then it can have, great, empowering, impactful long-term effects. So I think that's what we want to do, is just kind of clear up the air or unmuck up the waters. They're a little gray right now.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny. So when I was getting my master's, my advisor was a big kind of strength training guru, but he always liked to joke around with me. It's like, man, like, we spend all this time trying to figure out how to get slightly bigger for his kind of strength guys. And it's like, we do everything right, and we're talking like minuscule improvement, and we have to do so much to gain mass. And it's like, here you distance runners are, who are, running 60, 70, 80, 100 miles a week. And you're worried about going in there twice a week, doing some lifting. And you're worried about this thing that might take, an hour of your total 10, 12 hours of week of work of suddenly blowing you up and making you huge. Like it's that, like it's that easy,
Right.
And he made a great point. I'm like, yeah, you're right. Like, it's not that easy to get big. And it's definitely not that easy to get big when most of the time you have the genetics of a distance runner. So I think that's number one, is you actually have to try to put on bulk. It's not something that magically automatically happens when you just start lifting weights, which is always, always the fear.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to be very conscientious, really sucking down exorbitant amounts of protein, creatine, yep, all these types of things, and that, is bulk, because creatine just helps hold it, that water retention, to create more mass, but it doesn't get at what we're trying to create, which is more power. I think that's the key differential, is looking between what's bulk, what's mass, and what's actually creating, more power per stride in a runner. And also, too, just enhancing that bio-learning mechanism between the brain and the muscles, and really just getting that so those synapses are going boom, 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 and firing at high speed. So then your coordination effect at the end of a race, especially like the 800 or 1500, isn't as high as if you're just sitting there doing a bunch of planks and core circuits.
Exactly. And I think that's what we need to get away from, is I think a lot of times people have this conception of really lightweight kind of general strength, or as Vern Gambetta likes to tell me, garbage strength.
Right, yeah.
In the weight room, and just hit that up and all will be good. When the reality is, I mean, we're on the same page, is that you're looking to generate some of the same adaptations that even a sprinter would want, right? We're looking at power. Why? Because if we can impact just slightly more force into that ground and have that ability to, then it's going to help with efficiency. It's going to help with some of these neural components. It's a game changer.
Exactly. And I think that's the key thing, is understanding the, hormonal response that's happening with different types of lifting protocols. is critical. And that's where it's the difference between having a strength and conditioning certificate or having that intimate knowledge versus kind of more of that personal trainer that you have at LA Fitness, you know, that it has kind of this very generic, hey, we paid $500 to take this test, open book test online, pass you through so you can start being, you know, this kind of personal trainer. So it's a little bit, you know, different degree of sophistication, because those hormonal responses, especially where you place them in your training, you know, before a heavy workout, after a heavy workout, you know, how many hours you're doing that, or after a hard bout, is really critical, because it can help enhance the entire athlete, not only kind of firm up those big, you know, primary movers that we want to really address there in on the backside of the chain there with the hamstrings, glutes, you know, hips and quads, but also too just making sure that we're preparing the athlete to absorb that training effect on the track and combining it with the effect we want to see in the weight room to move them forward and get them to where ultimately we want them to be, which is that what I call the happy land of best fitness of my life syndrome, where it's like, coach, I'm in the best fitness of my life. I ran a PR on the 10K and I end the 800. I'm like, yeah, best fitness of my life syndrome. It's a happy place to be. Anything you step on track, the PR. And that's the kind of thing that keeps, you know, positive momentum and good vibes for every athlete moving forward.
Exactly. You know, when you talk about hormonal system, I mean, I love that stuff, first off. But the first name that comes to my mind, and someone who we both call friends and have worked with, is Alan Webb. Because if you looked at what he was doing with Scott Rasko out in Virginia, is his strength program set him up so that he had this monstrous anabolic profile that made it where he could bounce back and recover from so much, whether on the track or off the track. And, you know, one of the first things I noticed when out in grad school training for him is we'd go do some pretty hectic hard track session, and then right afterwards he'd go into the weight room and do a series of, you know, Olympic lifts, squats or cleans or whatever have you with pretty heavy weight. And he'd be fine. And the next day he'd come back, bounce back. And remember the first time I did this, and I'm coming from a guy who ran, you know, up to 120 miles a week in college, thinking like, oh, I can handle anything. Like I'm good to go. And the first time I went through these sessions of track and then weight, like I was toast. And then, but after months and months of doing this, my body adapted, and all of a sudden I was handling much more, not only in the weight room, but on the track.
Right, exactly. And that's, you know, that global adaptation, not only taking that macro perspective about how everything combines from the running to the non-running work you're doing, but also too, that patient improvement of, you know, season to season, year to year with an athlete is really important. Like, I think, you know, one thing when you look back at and talk to Alan about, like, his training that set him up for, you know, that magical kind of year where he ran, you know, that 27, you know, mid and the 10K, and then the following year broke the American record in the mile. He had just gone to an accumulation standpoint, and just so much of that his hormonal profile was off the charts. And you even look at it through his blood work in the last several years. I mean, it's like the guy has been at altitude his whole life. I mean, because he goes to altitude, and it really wasn't an impact for him because his hematocrit was already so high. I mean, what percentage gain is the guy really going to get from having a set of ice bath for five, you know, six, 7 weeks? So, and I mean, these are intense sessions. Like, Alan's going in, like, he's ripping 90 minutes in the weight room, and he's doing, like you said, like, you know, deep squats, cleans, you know, all those types of Olympic lifts, you know, big time bench press, because, you know, when we're talking about hormonal response, we're talking about massive tissue recruitment. So I think sometimes there's a little disconnect between, okay, well, pros get girls, but that's actually just more of a regional lift versus like a nice deep squat. That's the best, you know, in my book, activity you can do in the gym from a global mass tissue engagement, which is then going to stimulate a lot of hormonal engagement. It's going to help release testosterone and some HGH. That's going to help catalyze or be the catalyst for this kind of recovery process is going to happen with an athlete. Now, you have to be intelligent. We're not sitting here and trying to do two sets of 20 reps of deep squats. I mean, we're looking at something where it's moderate weight, about 80% of, I like to say, one max rep capacity, and, you know, doing anywhere between 6 to 8 reps, 1 to 3 times in a session. I mean, that's kind of standard par for the course. It's going to allow you to get outside your comfort zone, you know, with the last couple lifts, but not go to complete failure where then you're kind of overtaxing and toxifying the central nervous system because that weight's just dropping to the floor and you can't walk for the next 30 seconds because your body has to, you know, or just send all this flood of hormones just to say, hey, let's not pass out here. So, you know, again, the prescription is very, very important. And I think when you think about these kind of basic standard lifts, because it's not anything sexy, we're not, you know, you're not trying to sit here on the Swiss ball and touch a toe to your nose with one hand while the other, you know, hand's holding a 50-pound barbell straight up in the air type deal. It's, you know, the basics, the bench, the deep squat, the lunge walk, the lunge step up. Just think, how do you recruit the most muscle tissue that you're trying to engage from a primary functionality direct transfer standpoint to running into a weight session and making sure that you're keeping things kind of what I call that upper moderate type capacity. So more of a, you know, 2/3 to, you know, 5/8, 6/8 type maximum availability after a hard training session. Again, you know, when you look at it too, I mean, the other thing, you know, coaches, you want to think about is, it's not the primary activity. It's not the, you know, getting better in the weight room doesn't have a direct transfer getting better on track. You still have to run. You have to run fast. But it's a secondary activity that has critical secondary enhancement properties to it if you sequence it right. So remember that. I mean, a lot of times some coaches are like, well, you got to lift fresh, and you got to be 100% fresh, and you got to maximize this because otherwise, you know, the glycogen, you know, content of the muscles is way off, and then you can't lift as much. And it's like, no, we... You know, from my perspective, I want my athletes to be a little, you know, in a state of glycogen depletion after doing a long run or a good long, you know, workout session on the track. Because, again, we're forcing then the body to recruit new muscle fibers and engage new motor patterns that's going to help enhance the overall athlete down the road. So it's, you know, it's about the trade-offs, and you have to know the trade-offs you're making and what's primary to the development of the athlete you're, you know, working with in the training cycle you're in. So, you know, just, again, it's not just a clean slice of bread and everyone's happy. It's about, you know, knowing when and where to implement these things. I think that's where we don't, in the distance running endurance community, have the proper education, because it just hasn't been something that's been talked about enough. And so I encourage people, like, you know, go talk to your sprints coach, your throws coach, go talk to your strength and conditioning coach, go talk to your soccer coach, go talk, you know, to these coaches and these other modalities of athletics, because they have a little bit more familiarity with it because it's part and parcel for their coaching. So, you know, and we're luckily getting enough literature, getting enough press, getting enough exposure in the distance community in the last 10 years that this is something that's really, really hyper important.
Yeah, definitely. No, I mean, you made some great points there. I think, you know, my kind of takeaways on stuff is I like to keep things simple. And my take is, you know, big full body movements to recruit as much muscle mass as I want. If you look at what we're trying to accomplish in the weight room, it's a combination of hormonal plus neural, right? So we look at the hormones to prime the system, to maybe give us a little bump in terms of, recovery adaptation. Especially if we're looking at post track workout or post hard workout, is a lot of times we can use the weight sessions to put our body in a place to adapt to the track session. So by, you know, getting a nice, hit of testosterone or HGH or whatever it is, from doing some of these larger muscle mass recruited exercises, we can get that process going quicker. The other thing that I look at is like you said, is that when you train in a slightly fatigued state, we can do what I'd call as forcing muscle recruitment when we normally don't get muscle recruitment. So one of the biggest things that you look at for developing a kick or looking at fatigue is when fatigue happens, it's basically a inability of your brain to convince your muscles to recruit more muscle and to fire, right? So if we can come in a pre-fatigue state from the track or from out on the roads and then do something with a high neural demand, then we're already starting to ingrain that pattern of, hey, we know we're low on glycogen. We know we've got some fatigue byproducts in there, but we still have to get these pathways moving so that, hey, we need all those quads and hamstrings, whatever it is, to fire, right? And let's recruit those fast twitch muscle fibers that might not be able to do all the work. But if we can train that recruitment pattern in a fatigue state, then hopefully the idea is you translate that out onto the track.
Right, exactly. And this is something where it's like you want to hit this more in your general strength preparation
Correct.
Phase, as well as also kind of your early comp phase. You know, when you're trying to, you know, clicking on all cylinders here in like the harder competitions phase, as well as championship phase of racing, you know, that takes the precedent. And so that's where you want to feel good. You want to feel crisp. You want to feel clean. You want to feel choppy. You don't want to feel like choppy and bogged down and heavy legged by trying to tax too much in there. So this is something that you want to see about in your build up phase, however you want to define that. And then all you're doing when you're competing is you're just maintaining these lifts. I mean, you're just maintaining these neural pathways when a little fresher. So you're going in and it's just kind of like doing your good fast strides or your 150s,
yep.
You know, because you got a week between, you know, races, but you don't want to completely just stop doing it at all. It's like saying, well, we're in our championship phase, and so we're not going to run any day except our race day, and then we're going to take 6 days off. You're going to get a quick detraining effect that's not going to help at all. So be cognizant of that as well when you're kind of trying to integrate these things into your training. But even something as simple as just one times, you know, 4 to 5 reps of, you know, activity 2-3 times a week is going to, you know, stop that training effect and have a maintenance effect for up to like 6 weeks, as long as you're, you know, getting that high stimulus or high intensity stimulus of good fast work in between races and races themselves.
So, exactly.
Be hyper conscious of when, where, and how you're doing it. But if you do integrate this thing, I really see this as the game changer for a lot of, especially high school distance type coaching here in the next couple of years, and even the college level, to help, you know, enhance everyone, get everyone faster, because I think that's, you know, why we're on coaching and why we, you know, are at the track reading splits for a rep, and why athletes are running around in circles so, you know, they have no more energy, and why they're out there on the weekends doing long runs and all the extra things is, you know, the end game is always to get faster. So this is another key thing that, you know, I really encourage people to look into to help the athletes you're working with, or even yourself, if you're self-coached, get faster.
Exactly. I mean, that's huge. I think sequencing is important. I almost see it as when you're building your base or whatever you want to call it, we look at it as the extremes, right? We want that general endurance, that longer aerobic stuff. But at the same time, the other component of that base is that pure speed, pure strength foundation that we need to build. Right. And that's what this stuff does. And that's if we can hit it hard during that base or general prep or pre-competition, whatever you want to call it. And then just simply go into maintenance phase. And you know what a lot of times we do, for instance, what we're doing with our athletes right now is, I'll give you Mondays, but Mondays we came in and did one set of, I think it was squats and cleans and then a couple other exercises, but then ended with some, you know, easy power things where we did some box jumps to get to almost translate that power into something a little more functional, and that was it. So it's just a maintenance phase where it's like one set of five or six reps. It's still somewhat moderate, but keeps that pathway going. and then we'll pick it back up after indoors. We'll go back into another kind of general prep phase where we hit it hard a little bit before going into outdoors, and then back into kind of a maintenance plus translated into a little bit of power phase.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's spot on, Steve. We're totally doing the same type of stuff here. You know, the other thing I want to speak to real quick too is just, you know, maintaining the integrity of the velocity of the movements. So, you know, if you're doing like a multi jumps or box jumps, or if you're doing med ball work, or if you're doing some lifts, like you want to make sure that, you know, you're working at that kind of sweet spot of 80% type, you know, one rep max capacity, but that the bar speeds or the movement speeds or of the jump or the ball, what have you, is being maintained throughout the whole exercise. So you want to treat it, because it has this high neural component, just like sprinting, true absolute max velocity sprinting does, where you're making sure there's enough rest in between, you know, sets of reps and things that you're doing, so that you're not keep training these slow movement, or you're training these slower movement patterns that are actually what, you know, what I call junk lifting, or know, junk movements, because like, oh yeah, well, we're just gonna put as many plates on the barbell as possible and try to bench press, you know, five times with all these plates on and look good, you know, for Instagram shot or what have you. But, you know, after the third rep, I mean, that bar is moving real slow. Nothing's really going on from a beneficial standpoint that we want from, you know, kind of a coach athlete structure training plan. So that's when you need to, if you see that with the athlete, you know, you have this intention of saying, hey, we're going to do 2x5 sets, but, you know, the athlete's struggling there on the last couple reps of each set or something, you know, the weight might be too heavy that day. Even if they say, oh, hey, coach, well, 2 days ago or 3 days ago when we were in the gym last, I was benching the same, you know, weight at the same, at a much faster speed, and I felt great, so why would I want to, you know, go back down? And again, it's finding that sweet spot, that bar speed. So the bar speed never lies, as I always say. So that's the thing. I mean, you got to be aware of what your kind of, you know, current level of fitness is in the weight room. But you might have done, you know, those previous, the previous day when the athlete was hitting on all cylinders and moving that same weight just fine and dandy. It might have been like 10-200s in a really light neural workout from a volume standpoint. And they're feeling great. And then, you know, you might have been mile repeats, like 5-mile repeats at their, you know, goal 3K pace. And they're a little taxed and a little fatigued because, you know, high volume, high intensity day. So back off a little bit, because you still can get value out of that by lifting a little bit less weight, as long as the bar speed integrity is maintained.
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good point. I mean, just looking at bar speed again from a coaching standpoint is a great cue of how the fatigue is manifesting itself, and whether you're getting the adaptations and the stress of the workout that you want. You know, another topic, kind of segueing a little bit, that you touched on, or we touched on a little bit earlier, is what I'd call this mimicry of movement, okay, which I think is a big kind of misconception in the world of not only distance running, but all sports, really, is that there's been this trend to try and get a little bit fancy and use, you know, whether it's BOSU balls or stability stuff, which, don't get me wrong, you need some stability, but to use those kinds of things and almost try and do this, hey, we're going to mimic running in the weight room. So you get people doing, you know, lifts with on one-legged balance, trying to mimic some sort of running motion and things like that. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I've always felt that misses the boat, right? Because you're not trying to go into the weight room to mimic what the movement is outside. Because the movement is a very dynamic movement that occurs with a lot of stretch reflexes, a lot of neural components, right? That's not the point.
Right. I mean, when running do you have single leg contact for 5 seconds
exactly
under a 50-plus pound load? Or do you have, the single leg contact for 10, 30 seconds on a very uneven, unbalanced surface, you know, with a heavy load? Like it doesn't translate. I respect the creativity, and I respect the, you know, place the thought pattern came from. And it's kind of something you can do, I think, really in your off-season type deal, like, all right, this is just some fun stuff from a neuromuscular kind of coordination component that, you know, has a little bit of transfer, but it's just fun to break up the monotony of things. But I'm always a big fan of trying to think direct transfer effect, direct transfer effect. That can kind of really clear your plate in terms of, you know, you only have so much time that an athlete can perform exercises, you know, with good intensity and good integrity. So do the ones that have a direct transfer effect or the biggest direct transfer effect versus all these kind of indirect transfer, you know, coochie-woochie drills. You know, they're fun. They're cool to throw on YouTube and impress your friends with. But, I mean, that's about all really I think you're going to get out of it. And you spend all your time doing this stuff, and it's just not going to have the transfer you want. It's the same idea, concept of saying, okay, well, we're a distance runner, so we're going to go and we're going to just hit reps every day at the track. Some reps will be fast and short one day, then the following day we'll do long tempo reps, and then the following day we'll do VO2 reps. And, you know, you're going to spend all this time and energy doing all this stuff that you want to incorporate in your training, but the sequencing of it and the timing of it is just not going to give you the lasting impact that you want, which is basically doing the best athlete you can with the time you have tutoring that athlete for that season or the series of years. So, and that's always the end game, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that sums it up pretty nicely. Because you see that kind of mimicry, which, again, I'm with you. I like the creativity, but you got to remember what you're training for. And on that note, you know, one of the things that I always get asked from high school coaches, they're like, well, we only got so much time in here. How do we stick this in? Is that the first thing you start out with in terms of, I consider it strength training, is sprinting, right? Because it's a direct transfer. It recruits a ton more muscle mass than you would doing any other reps or any other workout. And we're talking, you know, pure speed sprinting here. It's like, start with that. Like, once your athletes can sprint, okay, great. Then you can move on to the next step and start getting them in the weight room and start doing some of the things we started with. But it doesn't mean you have to, you know, if you've never done any sort of speed or strength work before, it doesn't mean you have to go wholesale straight into the weight room, straight into doing some of these things. It's like, well, start outside, you know, go get your guys to sprint either on the flat ground or up a hill or whatever it is, and start getting those neural components and those muscle fiber components engaged. And
it goes back to clean slate phenomena that we talked about a couple podcasts ago. It's like, you know, sprint on a flat, then sprint up a hill, because that's resistance in and of itself, the direct transfer effect. And you have a lot of bang for your buck. But if you've already exhausted those things, if those are already been a part of your training plan for a certain athlete, and you need a new clean slate, that's when it's time to get into the weight room.
Exactly.
You know, again, it's secondary. I cannot preach that enough. It has a high benefit of a secondary component, but it is secondary training to the actual direct transfer effect of running training.
Exactly.
You know, that's also something that kind of gets lost in the shuffle as well, or lost in the shouting matches that you hear with all these well-intentioned coaches or well-intentioned, you know, speakers, just being like, hey, you got to do this stuff, it's really important, in which I agree. But if you're not getting enough running in, if you're not getting enough weekly, you know, or daily volume in, if you're not doing, you know, recovery regeneration runs, that's the engaging oxidative effect, that the glues that holds your training gear. You know, all this is a moot point here. So
exactly. You know, this is probably a good point to end it on, and just to reciprocate that a little bit. You know, when we I do all our strength stuff for our team now, but we originally had a weight coach, and we'd always go back and forth on this, because in his mind, like, going into the weight room was the most important thing. Maybe not the most, but highly important, right? And, well, I obviously see a lot of value, and I always said, this is secondary, right? It's of a lot of importance, but if what we do in here starts to take away significantly from what we are doing out there, then we have messed up the balance. You know, once we're adapted, obviously, at first you're a little sore, that's why you do it in the base phase. But once we're adapted, if this weight stuff is becoming so intense that it's starting to affect our ability to get in the volume we need or the next workout we need, then it's time to scale back, because we have to remember that the most important thing, the most specific thing, the biggest transfer we get is what we're doing out on the track, on the road, on the cross country course, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Cool. Well, hopefully this gave a little bit of controversy and a little bit of things to chew on. I certainly enjoyed it and got some good insight out of it. So thanks again, John, for podcast number 3.
Yes, yeah, always fun. Let's keep doing it.
All right. Thanks. We'll talk to you next week.
All right.